Okay. So it's my pleasure to introduce today's seminar speaker, Dr. Stephanie King. She's a behavioral biologist focusing on the role of vocal communication in mediating social behavior with a focus on cetaceans. She completed her bachelor's degree at the University of Leeds and then went on to receive a master's and PhD from the University of St. Andrews. In 2015, she was awarded a Branko Weiss Fellowship for 5 years, during which she started working on dolphin communication in Shark Bay in Western Australia. This is a long-term research project that she's now leading together with her collaborator. In 2019, she joined the University of Bristol, where she's now a senior lecturer. And today, she'll tell us more about her research on communication and cooperation in male dolphins. And we're very excited to have you here, and please take it away. Thank you.
Thank you, Sonia. I wanted to start by saying what a pleasure it is to visit Constance, both because I've realised what a beautiful city it is, but also because it's renowned for its world-leading research on animal collective behaviour, and for really setting the standard when it comes to robust and innovative techniques to study social complexity. So it is a pleasure to be here to talk about our work on group-level cooperation in bottlenose dolphins. And I think bottlenose dolphins and cetaceans in general are a really interesting study system when it comes to exploring animal social complexity. And I hope by the end of the talk, I will convince you of the same. So I wanted to start by just very briefly introducing some of the research questions that my group focus on to give you a flavor of the type of research that we do, because we focus on a number of questions. The first two are on the evolution of complex communication in animals, so what social and ecological pressures have led to communicative complexity. And we're also interested in the formation and maintenance of cooperative relationships and the communicative signals that individuals use to facilitate cooperative endeavours. And for both of those questions, we really work with wild animals, so wild populations of cetaceans. We're also interested in the cognitive mechanisms underlying cooperation. So we conduct cooperative problem-solving experiments with animals under human care. And we also ask questions on the impact of anthropogenic noise on cetacean behavior, both in animals under human care and in the wild. But for the focus of today's talk, I'm going to focus on the first two points, which is complex communication and cooperation. And for these questions, we primarily work with the Indo-Pacific bottlenose dolphin, these guys. So I hope you can see the video. But why work with a study system that's so difficult to monitor, to study, a species that spends most of its time submerged underwater? Well, I think there are a number of reasons why they're such a good system for the questions that we're interested in. The first is that they're vocal production learners, which means they learn the vocalizations they produce. They don't have a fixed repertoire of sounds. They're open-ended learners in that they can learn new sounds throughout their life. So they have high levels of vocal flexibility. Through playback experiments with individual identity signals, they've been shown to have long-term social memory. So memory of others that can last decades, similar to other long-lived animals, humans, elephants, etc. So they have the capacity to track individual relationships over the longer term. Cetaceans are also known for forming multi-level societies. So we have complexity with regards to their social organization. And dolphins in particular, the males form multi-level alliances, which is what I'm going to be talking about today. And finally, they engage in frequent cooperative behavior, both in terms of male reproductive cooperation and when foraging cooperatively together. I hope everyone's still able to see the presentation. Okay. So I work with a population of Indo-Pacific bottlenose dolphins in Shark Bay in Western Australia. So the location of Shark Bay is highlighted on the map for you. For some perspective, it's about 900 kilometres north of the capital city, Perth, which is highlighted by the star. And Shark Bay is it's a really special place. It's where the desert meets the sea. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Area, And it's famous for its vast seagrass meadows. It's got the largest population of dugongs in the world. It has stromatolites. And it also has this population of Indo-Pacific bottlenose dolphins. And this population has been studied since 1982. So it was set up by Richard Connor and Rachel Smolka, and we're in our 40th year this year. So it's a really rich data set in terms of social behavior and behavioral complexity. And before I talk about the research in Shark Bay, I just want to acknowledge the other principal investigators that work on the project, because this is very much a team effort. The research wouldn't be possible without everybody working together. And not just the principal investigators, but all the wonderful fellows and postdocs and PhDs and assistants that help us on this project. So the work that I'm talking about today is due to the hard work of all these people. But what I want to focus on is what we've learned about these alliances over the last 40 years. What has four decades of research on this population taught us about bottlenose dolphin behavioral complexity? The dolphins in Shark Bay are known for their different behavioral strategies and their social complexity. Tool use is prevalent in this population. But today I'm going to focus on the nested alliances. And this is when male dolphins engage in coordinated efforts to compete with rival alliances over access to females. And before I talk about this social structure, or this alliance structure in more detail, I think it's important. Do you want me to wait? No? I think it's important that we talk about dolphin social structure in general and how that compares to the social structure of other social birds and mammals. But for those of you that work on very different species, how do we keep track of individuals? How do we build a social network? How do we study social organization? And we use traditional photo identification techniques. So each dolphin has a very unique dorsal fin with regards to shape, with regards to scarring. You see these tears along the trailing edge, these little nicks and notches that we call them. To us, these are highly distinctive. You're out in the field on the boat, you can identify hundreds of animals by their unique dorsal fin. But we take photographs of these animals during the year and across years. We can document changes in these fins, and we can track the individuals over time. And this allows us to build up a picture of which individual associates with which other, who spends time together, who cooperates together, who engages in conflict. We also take biopsy sampling on an annual basis. So skin, blubber of these animals, we know who's related to who. We know who sired which calf. So we have lots of information on the population. So let's take a step back and just consider social structure in general, in many social birds and mammals. And typically, we see patterns such as closed or semi-closed social groups with males and females. These groups tend to form or establish territories, and we see sex bias dispersal, typically males in mammals. And what happens is when males become sexually mature, they leave their natal group and they move to a different group. Interactions within the group are largely affiliative, although obviously there's always conflict within when individuals are together, when we talk about social groups, but largely affiliative, and interactions between groups can be hostile. In the dolphins, we have something very different. They have an open social network within this population. So all individuals within the population can interact, can mix together. They can have different strengths of relationship, so they can have strong relationships with some and weak ones with others, but they have the potential to interact. There's no closed or semi-closed social groups, at least not in terms of mixing. I'll talk about the alliances shortly. They don't form territories. They might have home ranges, areas that they prefer to spend time, but they're not defending that from other individuals. So there's no territories, and there's no dispersal. Both sexes are philopatric, so they tend to stay in the area that they were raised. So we have this system where a very open social network with lots of fission fusion. So no closed or stable social groups in terms of different groups mixing, but they can have stable relationships. No territories. Instead, individuals reside in a mosaic of overlapping home ranges. And no dispersal. Both sexes are philopatric, which is very different to some of the social systems we see in other social birds and terrestrial mammals. And so I just wanted you to keep that in mind as I then talk about the alliance structure. So in Shark Bay, we have these nested alliances. And the core unit is very much the second order alliance. And the naming might seem a little strange, but that's because when the study was first started, it was these smaller first order alliances that were identified first. And later they realized they were part of actually a bigger alliance that was the core unit, right? The second order alliance. That can range in size from 4 to 14 males. 14 is the largest of the second order alliances that we have. Within that second order alliance, males will work together in pairs or trios to herd individual or single estrus females that are cycling, ready to conceive. So these first order alliances are formed almost exclusively from within the second order. And some males have really strong preferences over who they herd females with. So they tend to always herd females with the same males. And others are far more flexible and they'll herd females with any male from their second order alliance. So the first order within the second order. We also see significant association preferences between two second order alliances to form a third level. It can sometimes still be competitive between them, but largely they help each other out. One thing that I neglected to say, within the second order alliances, when a trio is herding a female and a rival comes to take that female, it's their second order allies that come in and help defend that female or steal another female, even if they don't get access to that female themselves. So the second order alliance is all about coalitionary support. Even if we're not herding females together, we help each other keep those females, or we help each other steal females from others. And the third order alliance increases the chance of having allies nearby. So you have this significant association preference. We still see things like cross-coalitionary petting between these males, so affiliative contact, and that they will also help each other out in times of conflict when someone tries to steal their female. And I just want to go through that again. So let's keep this in mind. We have the first order of 2 to 3 males who cooperate in female coercion. In that image is a nice trio. We have Julian, Floppy, and Osmo. Osmo's at the front. If you can see, he actually has a chopped dorsal fin, and I'll come on to why in a second. These three form a pretty tight first order alliance. They're second order allies. There are three others, so they form a 6-member second order alliance, so towards the smaller end of our second order alliances. But they're out there with Guignol, Gregor, and Canute, and these guys help each other in fights, help each other steal females or defend females. And I really want to emphasize that this coalitionary support, this support that they offer each other with regards to conflict over females, can incur or can be costly. There's a high risk of them incurring an injury. And Osmo is a great example here. So in 2016, we showed up during a fight between males. Here you can see during that fight, Osmo actually had his dorsal fin broken. This would have been through a tailstock. They're very strong, these animals. They whack each other with their tailstocks during these fights. You can hear that on the underwater microphones. It would have been an unlucky hit. But his dorsal fin was hanging down, and that's a pretty significant injury. Not only could that lead to internal bleeding or infection, but while he's compromised, it could increase his chance of being predated upon by sharks, tiger sharks, which is the main predator in Shark Bay. So we didn't actually see him for a few weeks. His allies were continuing to herd females, and he disappeared. And then it was 6 weeks later, I think, we'd left the field, Sonia was still there, and we got this message saying, guess who's just shown up? Straight in, back with his allies. The dorsal fin that was hanging down had come off. Osmo had recovered, and that's how he's ended up with his really unique fin. But we see fights, conflict like this frequently. So there's a risk for these males. They're helping each other keep a female, even though there's no immediate benefit for them. So we have first order, second order, and then the third order alliance. Significant association preferences between two second order alliances that help each other, again, maintain access to females. A couple of things I want to highlight about these second order alliances. They're very much the core unit, as I've said, of male social organization. This figure shows you parts of our field site, so from Monkey Mia up to Gieschenor Point, that's about 20 kilometers. In this image, each circle is a male. They're color coded by second order alliance. And males that are alliances that are similar in colour form a third order alliance. So not every second order alliance has a third order alliance, but many do. And the lines obviously represent the relationships between individuals, where we've removed observations when they were foraging in case they were aggregating on a food patch but weren't actually interacting. We've removed fights. It just highlights that this alliance network is connected. They know each other. They have relationships with each other. And while largely this is competitive, outside of the mating season, they may well spend time together. Once these second order alliances are formed, membership is closed. So they start forming them in their early teens, they can live up to their 50 years old. It's very rare we get males coming to join that second order once it's established. They indeed lose members, but very rarely do you get other males joining. They're also stable over decades. So here we have three alliances colour-coded in yellow, blue and red, three second orders. This was using association indices, measure of how much time individuals spend together, hierarchical clustering to group males together. These groupings always accurately reflect what we see out in the field, functional behavior. It's the same males that are herding females. It's the same males that are helping each other in these fights, right? And this is a snapshot from 2001 to 2019, but these males are continually grouped together. They're the ones we see in the field continually herding females, fighting over them. So the alliances are stable. They've lost members, but they haven't had new members join, and they've remained stable over decades. So we have this really interesting system where they start crystallizing in the early teens, and they can live till they're 50 years old, and these big groups of males working together. So how are these alliances formed? How do you choose who's in your alliance? And there's some really nice work being done by Dr. Livia Gerber. So she did her PhD with Michael Crutzen at the University of Zurich, and she's now a postdoc at UNSW. And her PhD looked at the ontogeny of alliance formation. So she was looking at when animals were young, what attributes predict who they form alliances with in the future. So she looked at the relationship between young males before they're sexually mature, adolescents, juveniles, the bond strength between those individuals, and the bond strength between them as adults. So the first thing is that who you form strong bonds with when you're young predicts who you form an alliance with in the future. She also looked at kin availability. So are they forming alliances with related individuals, or what else was playing a role in alliance formation? And she found that males do not preferentially ally with kin. Indeed, even if kin is available, if kin are available, they tend to form alliances with similarly aged males that they've started investing relationships or vested time in those relationships. So a young male in Shark Bay becomes independent from its mum at 4 years of age, and it's not sexually mature until he's 12. So we have this extended juvenile period where they start investing in these relationships that are going to be important for their future reproductive success. And what predicts alliance formation is age and the amount of time they spend together. Conceivably testing each other out as potential alliance partners. Who's testing each other's potentially competencies when it comes to alliance formation? And I actually have a PhD student looking at this right now and looking at the kind of behaviors these young juveniles engage with in, which is lots of social play and lots of practicing herding behavior that will be important as adults, taking turns in the role of the female when they're practicing these herding events. So it's very cool stuff. So these alliances are formed when they're really young. They crystallize in the early teens. They start herding females quite aggressively in the early 20s, and they can last for decades. But what are the fitness benefits? Like, what is the benefit for a male to form these alliances? And few, if any, males in the population are unallied, so they always tend to form an alliance. And Livia looked at, within second-order alliances, what could explain male reproductive success. So she looked at whether node strength, so within a second-order alliance, your cumulative social bond strength with your second-order allies, does that predict the number of paternities? So the number of strong bonds you form. She also looked at the variation in bond strength within the second-order alliance. And she found that the number of paternities positively correlated with cumulative social bond strength and negatively correlated with variation in bond strength. So well-integrated males with more homogenous social bonds in the second order alliance tend to do better. They have higher paternities. We've recently looked at what benefits there might be of third order alliances. We think this is interesting. Here you have alliances between groups, if you like. The second order is the core unit. And that also increases access to females. And here we looked at two metrics. We didn't have the paternity data, but we looked at consortship rate, how frequently you heard females. And we looked at consortship duration, how long does an individual consortship last for, which can vary from a few hours or a day was our minimum unit, to our maximum was 63 days. So these can last weeks at a time. Looking within second order alliances, we replicated Livia's work as we would expect in that cumulative social bond strength within the second order alliance predicts both consortship rate and duration. But importantly, bond strength between alliances, these third order alliances significantly predicts consortship rate and duration. So how frequently you have females and how long you can keep them for. And this makes sense in that our hypothesis was always, well, increases these third orders increase the chance of having allies nearby, either to help you steal a female, or it's one less group of males that may steal your female. But when we put alliance size into these models, second order alliance size has no impact on consortship rate or duration, and third order alliance size does. So it's very much about increasing the number of allies nearby to help you maintain access to females. I now want to talk about relationship complexity, because we have these very distinct levels. But actually, bond strength or social bond strength within the alliances and the rate that individuals herd females together is highly differentiated. So if we take that figure as just a very simple network plot and the lines representing the strength of the social bond, you can see that some males have really strong bonds within the alliance and others will have weaker bonds. So I might be really well connected to many males in my alliance, but I might only have a weak relationship with a couple of others, but they're well connected to other individuals. So these relationships are highly differentiated, which means that males need to keep track of many different relationships, both within and between alliance levels, which can pose some significant cognitive challenges. And just to show you this with some real data, again, we have the hierarchical clustering based on association index, which is a measure of bond strength. And we have these three alliances. And just to highlight that within each alliance, you get some males that are really well connected and other males which have weaker relationships. Nonetheless, they're all members of this second order alliance. We also see relationship complexity at multiple levels. So because relationships are so differentiated within the second order alliance, you can end up with bond strength. So this, let's say this is two second orders forming a third order. Some relationship strengths with third order allies are equivalent to the relationship strength you have with some second order allies, right? So it's your weaker relationships within the second order could be comparable to some of the stronger relationships you have with your third order alliance. Again, this is how much time individuals spend together. That's how we measure bond strength. Show this with real data, and I know there's a lot to take in here, but on the y-axis we have bond strength, so it's an association index, the simple ratio index, and it's from 0 to 1. So 0, animals are never seen together, 1, they're always seen together. Along the x-axis we have time, so 1989 to 2019, and we're interested in these blue, red, and yellow alliances. The purple is the relationship between the blue, red, and yellow alliance, so the third order alliance relationships, and the grey is just the relationship that those three different alliances have with other males in the population. And again, two things to highlight is that within the second order, again, highly differentiated relationship strengths, weak and strong, but also overlap between third order allies and second order allies. Some of your stronger third order alliance relationships are equivalent to your weaker second order alliance relationships. So bond strength between some third order allies are comparable to those between members of the same second order alliance. And this led me to think, well, okay, given all this differentiation in the relationships, how do they classify these alliance levels? How do they determine who is in their second order and who are these other males within their third order? So one thing that's really interesting with bottlenose dolphins is that they develop these really distinctive individual identity signals, which we call signature whistles. This is an example of the signature whistles of two different individuals. And we have frequency along the y-axis and time along the x-axis. And it's this frequency-modulated pattern that you can see that encodes the identity of the animal. It's highly stereotyped, so it's always the same whistle that's produced. And the structure is very different between individuals. This isn't a contact call with subtle differences. The structure of the whistle is different between individuals. So I'm going to play these so you can have a listen. We'll see if it works. Maybe just on my computer. This one's a bit louder. They look very different, they sound different, and indeed there's many males now on the boat where we're recording and listening as we're recording, and I'll be like, that's CB or that's Pastor, because they have such distinctive whistles. So they have these individually distinctive whistles that are developed in their first year of life. They're vocal learners, so they're not born with these whistles. They have to develop something that's distinctive, unique to them, within the first few months typically. The identity information is encoded within the frequency modulation pattern, independently of voice cues. Playbacks have been done where they've done computer-generated versions of these whistles and conducted playbacks, and the individuals respond in biologically meaningful ways. So it's the structure of the whistle that encodes identity. They're stable over the lifetime of an individual. This has been shown in a number of populations. We're talking 20, 30 years, so they're stable. And playback experiments with signature whistles have shown that this species has decade-long social memory, remembering the signature whistles of individuals they haven't seen up to 20 years. So we know that dolphins have these signature whistles that they can use to identify each other. And when we first started looking at these males, we were like, maybe they could converge or change some aspect of their signature whistle, so to give it perhaps an alliance-specific component. And that's because many social birds and mammals converge on vocalizations as they form strong social bonds. It's called vocal accommodation. Humans do it. You might move to a new city or a new geographical area, and you start to pick up some of the local dialect. It's a natural thing to do. So we went out here again. We have a network plot, each male color-coded with an arrow grouped into their alliances, and we identified the signature whistle of each of those males across three second-order alliances. And we did a number of different techniques in terms of quantifying similarity, both at the level of the whistle and at small components of the whistle, to look at finer similarities, see if there was finer levels of similarity. And using a number of different approaches, we found no evidence of similarity between second-order allies. Indeed, you were more likely to have a whistle similar to somebody who was in a different alliance than you were in your own alliance. So there was no evidence of convergence. They retained their own unique vocal labels. And perhaps that's not surprising if, you know, relationships are highly differentiated and they want to keep track of their own relationships at the individual level. But what else could they be using then to classify their relationships? Well, it's been shown in other social birds and mammals that individuals can use other traits to predict or classify group members, both in terms of dominance rank, matrilineal kinship, and social bond strength. And some baboons have even been shown to hierarchically classify group members based on both dominance rank and kinship. So perhaps there's some other traits they can use. Well, we know they can't use signature whistles because they're very different between males. There's no alliance, second-order alliance signal. We know it's not relatedness. These males are generally unrelated. Perhaps they could use some aspect of bond strength or consortship history, but like I've said, they're really differentiated within and between the alliance levels. But one thing they could use is knowledge of cooperative relationships. Like I said, the second-order alliance is consistent in the coalitionary support, that they'll always come and help each other defend females and steal females. And that can be explained by direct reciprocity, where second order allies will help each other in the expectation this will be reciprocated in the future, or maybe even pseudo reciprocity if perhaps they actually do get access to that female at a later date. So our hypothesis here was that males may learn all the signature whistles of the males they interact with and use their memory of previous cooperative interactions to classify relationships, which males are consistently cooperating with me with regards to maintaining access to females. And because these second-order alliances start so young and they last decades, it creates these conditions for investment in team members, if you like, based on the value of the cooperative behaviour, so either future byproduct benefits and or reciprocity. So what we did was we wanted to conduct some playback experiments to these males. We wanted to look at how they responded to the signature whistles of first-order allies, which isn't binary, but it would be quantified by how many times they've consorted females together, so first-order preference. How they responded to signature whistles of second-order allies, and also third-order allies. And for this, we used drones to measure the response of the animals. And this has really changed the way that we're able to do field work. We can get so much information now on the behavior of these animals to playback experiments. We can continually track them when they're beneath the surface. We can capture fine scale responses such as head turns that occur underwater that we wouldn't be able to see from the boat. So we have a lot more information available to us now. So we conducted these signature whistle experiments, and I just want to show you a couple of examples of the types of behavioral response before I show you the results. So on the left, this is an example of a strong response to a playback. Top left, we have the playback source. So we're playing back the sound about 100 meters behind the animals as they're moving away from us. T0 is the time of playback. T+2 seconds after we've played back the signature whistle treatment, the animals are starting to turn. 20 seconds later, they're still orientated towards us. And 30 seconds later, the same. As well as orientating towards us, they also approach. So they could approach tens of meters back to where we were when we played the whistle. The example on the right is a much weaker response. Again, playback is behind the animals around 100 meters. You see a subtle head turn by the animal at the front, and then these animals continue moving in the same direction, orientated away from us. So for these playbacks, we measured response strength in as either response duration in seconds, so how long the response lasted for, and that's until they returned to pre-playback behavior, and also approach distance in meters, so how far the distance that they approached us. And we also measured whether they gave a vocal response to the playback. And what we saw was that there was a significantly longer response duration to playbacks of signature whistles from their second order alliance compared to their third order alliance. And here in that plot, we have second orders in red, third orders in blue, and the triangles I've just highlighted where you have weaker second order bond strength and stronger third order. They're comparable. Just to see, was bond strength playing any role here? We also found they had a significantly greater approach distance to second-order allies compared to third-order allies. And in both of these models, we included current social bond strength. We included number of consortships, which is a proxy for first-order preference. And neither of these explained the response. Indeed, there was also no interaction between current social bond strength and alliance membership. It was second-order alliance membership that drove this response. I found the lack of effect of consortships really interesting, because the consortships are so important for their reproductive success in terms of that's when they get access to females. And if, again, we look at this matrix highlighted by second order alliance membership, some males have consorted females together frequently and others rarely, or some frequently and others none at all. And yet they're still showing such a strong response to those second order allies that they hadn't consorted females with before. And I'm going to show you a video here, one of the playbacks. So this is three males. Ridges, the male on the right-hand side, responds first. And then we have Fred and Big, and they have a female Duchess. And we play back the signature whistle of one of their second-order allies, Nat. Nat and Ridges have never consorted a female together that we've observed, and they have a weaker bond than Ridges does with the other males. But you'll see his response when we play back the signature whistle of Nat. So you'll hear the whistle. I'll turn my volume up. Bridges immediately turns, followed by the others. You can even hear after the second whistle we played back, he also responds with his own signature whistle. And they stayed orientated towards us. They moved towards us and then stayed orientated towards us for a significant amount of time before moving off. Conceivably, you wait. Your second order allies have called. Do they need you? Do they need you? You wait. And then they moved off when there was no further vocal behavior. And for the third order allies, we could see head turns. Occasionally they'd turn around or they would just ignore the whistle. And these playbacks were all standardized for source level, playback same distance, etc. So what information are they using then to classify their alliance relationships? Doesn't seem to be consortship history because they still show a really strong response to second order allies that they haven't herded females with. It doesn't seem to be current social bond strength because again, bond strength didn't explain the response to those playbacks. It shows us those alliance relationships are not equivalent. It should be a not equivalent. but second and third order aren't the same, right? There's clearly a strong response to second order versus third order. And this is the interesting bit. Long-term familiarity cannot explain response because all these males within the second order and third order grew up together. They all knew each other as juveniles. We first photographed them as young animals associating before they'd formed their alliances. This isn't about how long I've known someone. And relatedness can't explain this because these males are generally largely unrelated. But it may be that the cooperative history of the second order alliance is what's important. That consistency in supporting each other over access to females. Over the lifetime of these males, these alliance relationships are critical for their reproductive success in gaining access to these females. And we've shown that these second order alliances are important in terms of defense of females and stealing females. So it seems that males can categorize their second order allies as team members independently of bond strength across all three alliance levels. It's the second order alliance that's the core unit, the team. So really, these playbacks are reinforcing what we'd always predicted based on what we'd seen in the field and how we'd quantified their relationships. And one thing that we suggest is that they can form this associative concept of team membership, where they associate the unique signature whistle that's unique to a particular individual and the history of cooperative interactions with that individual, identifying which members are part of their second order alliance or core team. So these alliance relationships are really important, and we wanted to then look at, well, how are they maintained? You have these groups of males that can be quite large. What mechanisms or behavioral strategies do they use to maintain these alliances? And this was some really nice work by a master's student in my group, Emma Shizkin, who looked at bonding mechanisms in these dolphins. And I'm going to show you a really nice video here. Here you have three males petting each other. So rubbing their pectoral fins against each other, their body parts, it's filiative contact behavior. Since we've been using drones, we've realized how frequently this occurs between the males, even if they have a female present. They spend a lot of time petting each other, maintaining, reinforcing these bonds. And synchrony is also a really important part of the male alliance behavior, and I'm going to talk about that just in a second. But the video, you can see there's a nice, we call it a tango, where the males are all moving synchronously, changing direction with each other. So synchrony is an important part. But these alliances, like I said, can be quite big. So how do they invest that time and energy in servicing all these relationships, in maintaining all these bonds? And so we looked at the rates of affiliative contact behavior between males in a second order alliance. And we also looked at rates of vocal exchanges. And this was based on Robin Dunbar's social bonding hypothesis, that as groups became larger and more complex, you couldn't invest as much time and energy into servicing bonds with grooming behavior. So this was originally talking about humans and primates. So you couldn't invest all this time in physical contact And that led to vocal grooming, so vocal exchanges, allowing you to groom at a distance, maintain relationships at a distance, and that what he hypothesized led to the evolution of language. But we found a really nice pattern here in that allied male dolphins within the second order alliance that had weaker social bonds displayed much higher rates of whistle exchanges. And we only looked at this when males were together, right? So not when they were apart, but when males were in the same group, much higher rates of vocal exchanges with weaker between males with weaker bonds, and significantly higher rates of affiliative contact between males with stronger bonds. So males that overall spent more time together, conceivably then that had the stronger social bonds, would invest more time in the physical contact, but in order to maintain all of their alliance relationships, males will also use vocal exchanges to maintain bonds with weaker allies, showing that vocal exchanges could function as a replacement for affiliative contact behaviour as a way of maintaining bonds in this system. I'm going to finish off the last part of the talk talking about synchrony, because when I first arrived in Shark Bay, this was so striking to me. These males are so synchronous with one another, performing the same behaviours at the same time, surfing synchronously, travelling synchronously, performing coordinated synchronous displays. And we knew that physical synchrony was an alliance-specific signal. It's males in the same alliance that engage in all this synchrony. But during my time there, I also started to notice occurrences of acoustic synchrony and coordination. So when males are herding females, they produce a threat vocalization called POPs. It's a narrowband, low-frequency pulsed call that's produced in trains, exclusively produced by males, almost exclusively produced when they're herding females. And what happens is when the male starts popping, and I'll play this in a second so you can hear what that sounds like, females tend to turn and come back towards them. It's when she moves too far. They're not happy. If she doesn't, this can escalate to physical aggression, right? So then maybe they'll charge her. So typically we see the female return to the male. And I'll play this so you can hear what this sounds like. So really distinctive vocalization. During recordings, we frequently see these single pops, but we'd started to hear and see in the spectrograms, like the visual representation of the sound, these double pops. It sounded like two males were popping at once and coordinating their pop production. And we wanted to explore this. It's challenging assigning vocalizations to a species that primarily spends most of its time underwater and where sound can be omnidirectional, right? It can travel in all directions. So we use an acoustic localization to ascribe vocalizations to a particular individual. And this image just shows we have a towed hydrophone array, so underwater microphones at positions H1 to H4. As sound travels through the environment, it hits each underwater microphone at a different time. We can then calculate time of arrival differences between each pair of hydrophones, and for each pair, plot all the potential locations of where that sound came from, and they converge on the point of the localizing animal, the source. And we calibrated the array to look at error, so we might take a sound has to be within 30 degrees of an individual for us to be confident, a whistle, for example, that's assigned to that individual. But we went through and localized all these pops. So at the top, you can see male A and male B and the bearing. Oh, one thing that I should say is the bearing estimate is if you're on the boat, 0 degrees is ahead of you, 180 degrees is behind you, and we're continually saying which dolphin is where. So as well as having overhead video, we're saying the IDs of the animals. CB's at 90 degrees now, 10 meters. We're continually putting that information in. So here we have males confirmed, their pops confirmed to be produced from two different males with the associated bearings. And we found that when males, it was two males popping in these coordinated trains, and two, that they were matching each other's tempo. Now, these pops aren't produced with increasing or decreasing tempo. They can be produced with either pattern. We did an individual analysis first. So that can change from pop train to pop train. But when they were popping together, then they would start to converge on the same tempo, and they were matching each other's interpop intervals. And we also found that they would synchronize pop production, starting and stopping at the same time. Pops can have anywhere from 4 to 12 or 15 pops in the train. That's also variable. And they would start and stop popping at the same time. So we start to see that as well as physical synchrony and coordination, acoustic synchrony and coordination is also important. As is petting. And it's interesting to think why these behaviours are so important for these males. And one hypothesis that we have is that it also could be used to form and maintain bonds, if there's a hormonal mechanism here. We know in some species grooming leads to oxytocin release, which is a bonding hormone. In humans, we've shown that synchrony can also lead to oxytocin release and can improve coordinated action. These trios of males have to work together to keep that female with them, to get access to that female. But ultimately, they're also competing for a resource that's indivisible, and that they don't all get to have a paternity or father and offspring with that particular female. And potentially, there's some underlying tension there. Whether these mechanisms evolved solely for social bonding or as a byproduct, it's adaptive in that it releases oxytocin. Bonds are, they feel these bonds are strong and they're maintaining these bonds, and then we have this feedback loop. And we're actually conducting playback experiments at the moment to see whether synchrony could be used to intimidate rivals or females, impress the females, or maybe whether it has a social bonding function. Because in humans, we see really nice examples of coordinated acoustic and physical displays that not only promote team bonding, but also intimidate rivals. And so we're trying to get at the function of at least acoustic synchrony with playbacks. It's almost impossible for us to get hormones like oxytocin from wild dolphins. So while I'd love to look at that, I'm not sure that that's possible. And we also have Danai Papagiorgiou, who is joining our project on a Marie Curie fellowship. I know she's familiar to most of you, if not all of you. She'll be looking at the epigenetic drivers and also fitness consequences of variation in synchrony. Are males that are better coordinating and synchronizing, are they more successful with females? Do they have more paternities? So to summarize, I think some of the key take-home messages about nested alliances and what we know about them is that we have these unrelated males that form these lifelong cooperative partnerships with one another that are critical to their reproductive success. That they can classify their core alliance unit, their team members, likely based on the cooperative investment in the team. Multiple mechanisms are needed to service bonds, both vocal and physical, and that synchrony indicates alliance unity and likely promotes cooperation among allies. So I just want to end by again acknowledging all the wonderful people that work on the project with us, and also thank you for your time.
Your flawless performance despite the technical difficulties, which puts you right on the shortlist of our Speaker Resilience Award, which I will introduce as now. So thank you very much. And so the floor is open to questions. Ari, first.
I have two questions, one from me and one from Meg, who had to run out, but just was burning to ask a question. So Meg's question, before I forget it, was how do third quarter alliances form? And then my question is about when you were talking about how they classify second versus third order alliances, and I was wondering if they might, like I think all the things that you talked about were kind of dyadic level things,
mm-hmm.
and I was wondering if they might be using information from their partners. And like in particular, I was wondering whether you've looked at in those playbacks, whether like when you have a group, is it the one that with the stronger bond that responds first, and then maybe the others are paying attention to that one?
We took the individual that responded first because we didn't want to take an individual that responded later if it was stronger in case it was influenced by the first animal that responded. But actually, the one that responded first always responded the strongest. That's the current bond strength value that we took. So it was the strongest, the animal that responded strongest, it was the current bond strength that we took because it was, you're absolutely right, it was at that dyadic level. And also the consortship history. Because the animal that responded first always responded the strongest, we kind of are able to account for that. Third order allies is interesting because they form later when they're adults. And you know, it does tend to be with males that are still, well, they're familiar with them and they're in the same area, but they are all familiar with each other. And we've only just now shown like the potential reproductive benefits of third order alliances. So I think you're right, that might be a really nice study to go back and look at the individual histories of those males that form third orders and see what might be explaining their formation. You know, anecdotally, there's a couple that have maternal half-brothers, but there's lots that don't, and really kinship doesn't seem to be a strong signal in this population. It's something we should definitely look at.
Thanks.
Yeah. I think you had your hand up earlier. Yeah.
Thanks, that was really cool. I had a question for you mentioned this reciprocity stuff, and in the video you showed, it was responding even though they haven't been hurting females to get it.
Yeah.
So how does that go together with
reciprocity?
Rely on former interactions?
Because, yeah, exactly. So, but it's not the cooperation at the herding level, but the defense of females, right? Because all the time these guys are like, if another rival comes in, Nat and Wab and Prima, the three that, you know, the other members of the Second Order Alliance come in. They'll even surround the female, well, the three that had her do the fighting, and then the three that had the female get her back, right? It's that level that's so striking, that coalitionary support in the pursuit and defense of females.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you.
You talked about that it takes a few months for that signature to form, but what happens while it's forming? Like, how are there patterns that you observe in terms of the living group? Are there pressures that you see about, like, actually diverging, or is it just sort of randomly trying stuff until it kind of lands
on
something?
So there's no group, right? Yeah. Well, if you think about it, when the young dolphins are with their mums, it's lots of mixing. But there's two things there. Is one, we see lots of babbling, like lots of they're practicing the vocalizations, and they don't look very, like the whistles can be quite, lots of side bands in the structure, like they're struggling to control amplitude, and they're producing all these different types. But studies have actually looked at what influences the structure of those whistles, which I think is what you're getting at. And really they're more similar, they'll pick up sounds from their environment and they'll develop something different. And so in populations in the wild, in Sarasota, they've shown that males, or calves will form signature whistles that are very dissimilar from individuals they associate with frequently, and they're more similar to individuals they rarely associate with. That's probably by chance, because how many different whistle structures can you make? But they make something different. In captivity or under human care, there's lots of flat components to the whistle. That's probably because they hear the trainer's bridge a lot. I mean, they're still modulated, but they have more of those than we see in the wild. Again, it's hearing sounds in your environment and creating something that's unique. And you get population differences, because again, this is vocal learning, but you're exposed to these sounds and you develop something that's within maybe similar to what you hear, but a bit different. But between populations, then you could maybe get very big differences, because they're exposed to different sounds. And then my earlier work also showed that females will increase their signature whistle production postpartum by up to 10 times 10, right? So she's always producing her whistle, so the calf imprints on that whistle. So if there's a separation, it can respond to its mum's signature whistle before it develops its own whistle, right? Because that's important. You have this mobile offspring, and if it's separated, it needs to be able to identify mum because it hasn't got its own signature whistle yet. So that's quite interesting, and that declines a few weeks after the birth of the calf, but it significantly increases just after the calf's born.
I have two questions. First one was, how do you look at how these pairwise signature whistle exchanges?
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's a methodological question. And secondly, also, this is more of a thought experiment. What would happen if you had a group of four dolphins and you actually played back the whistle of one of the dolphins that's in the group?
So
did you just ignore it?
No, both good, very good questions. So the first one is, whistle exchanges are, if one dolphin produces its signature whistle, the other one has to reply within a second. And that's because of all the studies we've looked at countercalling in different populations, that seems to be an optimum time, right? Which makes sense. It's a dynamic social world that can change, sound travels quickly, they're very vocal, so it has to be an immediate response. For my PhD, I looked at signature whistle copying, which is what happens, it's not that common that it makes the identity system unreliable, but sometimes they'll copy each other's signature whistles, and I was interested in why that might be. Vocal matching in birds can be very aggressive, so why were dolphins doing this kind of matching? So we'd play back computer-generated versions to individuals of their own whistle and other familiar whistles, and they nearly always respond when they hear their own whistle by calling back, as if they're addressed, right, because it pertains to them, and they don't always the vocal responses aren't that common or aren't as frequent, just to familiar whistles. And you saw from our playbacks, out of 40 playbacks, we only got 2 vocal responses. And it was always second order allies replying vocally to second order allies, but the strong response was a physical one. So I'm not saying that they wouldn't respond to the whistles of familiar individuals, but it's a different response to hearing your own signature whistle and then replying as if you've been addressed. So that tends to happen. And we didn't do that here because we were interested in the alliance relationships, but while we were calibrating the speaker near shore, we're like, there's no dolphins around, but we played back one of the males in the sequences to calibrate the speaker, and the male was obviously within hearing distance and replied and produced his signature whistle. So like even anecdotally, that still, you know, just confirms all the earlier work that we've done. Yeah.
Here's a question from the Zoom chat.
Yeah.
Oskarbitze asks, what are the females doing? Do they decide anything as well regarding reproductive partners? Or are they either stolen or defended by a male alliance and do not have much choice?
So, no, they don't have... It is sexual coercion. They don't have much choice. Some females don't want to be herded and they'll try and bolt. So bolting is something that we see a lot. She'll try and move away from the males and then she'll like speed off really quickly. And that's why they try and keep the female close to them. Other times the female seems to be quite happy and just carries on foraging and the males will just make sure they stay with her. It might be something about their history, whether she knows the males or not. Some males will come in and take the female from an area she wants to be in and take her where they want to be. And what's interesting, and I didn't talk about tool use, but in Shark Bay, we have sponging dolphins that use marine sponges as a foraging tool. It's very female biased. They spend time in deep channels. That's where they have to forage. And we found a trio with a sponger in the shallow waters, just with the sponge still on her rostrum, but she can't forage. And they've obviously taken a sponger and been like, well, I want to be over in the shallows. You know, that's where I spend my time. So, but there could be an element of female choice here, right? So to mate, they have to come belly to belly. And there was a really interesting study within the last 2 years looking at the structure of the vaginal folds of the female dolphins. And they just by subtle body movements, they can prevent copulation or even whether the male is successful. So it might be that they have to keep that female with them for as long as possible. And maybe that's where these displays come in, around the female. Maybe there's an element of we are demonstrating that they are a successful, strong alliance, which encourages her to mate with them. We still don't know that, and that's something that we'd be interested to look at. Females are also polyestrous, so they'll cycle a number of times throughout that season, probably to confuse paternities. And so multiple males can herd that female for extended periods of time. So there's also a mechanism there that if one, you know, to confuse paternity, males don't know which females they may have side a calf with.
Thank you.
Okay.
I was just wondering how they synchronize, whether you have some information on that, whether there's some dominant, you know, one following the other, or whether they come together.
Seems to be together, so we tried to look at like leader-follower dynamics and whether it's one male that's initiating this, and it doesn't seem to be in the analysis that's been done, and Richard Connor had a paper out on that recently. I'd like to do more fine scale stuff with the acoustic coordination. It's very difficult. We can determine it's two males popping, but if they're next to each other, we can't determine which male. We just know that the bearings are consistently different. And that's what I'd really like to get at in a bit more detail. But with physical synchrony, we haven't seen evidence of that. Anecdotally, from the displays, which I didn't show a video of, when they do these coordinated displays, some males are really good at doing it together, and sometimes the third male's struggling to keep up. And it may be males that practice this more or are more in tune with each other are better. We still don't understand the mechanism there. So something that we'd like to continue looking at. Yeah.
I was wondering about the difference in mating success between males of an alliance. And I guess one thought was maybe the females are controlling that and the male might be mating but not actually successfully.
Mm-hmm.
But also, are there changes in the mating success during the decades that they're alive? Like say that a member of their group that it was very successful dies or leaves, do they then become more successful?
This is my next study that I've been trying to do and haven't found the time. I want to look at alliance attrition. As they lose members, how did the dynamics of that alliance change? It's hard to get enough paternity data, right? We have to sample calves when they're 2 years and older, but calf mortality is quite high. And so but we're building up that data set, right? So yes, maybe there is something about some males may become more popular when they lose a successful male. And we've certainly seen that, right? That some males engaging in more consortships because they've lost a key male in the alliance. Whether we can link it to paternity data, I'm not sure, but consortship rate seems to be a really good proxy in the models for paternity, so we can look at that. I think there might be some elements of the female, but if you're a good male and you can get access to as many females as possible over your lifetime, then overall you're going to have more opportunities. So, what's interesting is we do obviously get skew within the alliance. Some males are better at securing paternities. You know, they have more homogenous social bonds and probably more males they can herd females with, and they're really well connected. But when we looked at really strong trios, so that have a really strong preference just to herd together, there doesn't seem to be evidence of reproductive skew. And maybe over the lifetime, you know, they get an equal opportunity. But there's certainly some skew within the second order because some males are more successful.
Since they don't have any like dysfunctional mechanisms, so how can they avoid mating with the flow skin, or do they have any mechanisms to avoid?
No, they're you know, it's a large population, but both sexes are phylopatric. I mean, there is a high level of inbreeding, and I have seen males, older males, herd their sister or their mum. They can identify their mum, right, from signature whistles. Maybe he's helping his buddies, but I don't know if it's hard to observe the matings. So I don't know whether he would actively mate with his mother, but we certainly see them involved in herding events. Yeah.
Any more questions? Not from the chat either. So thank you all so much for coming. And Sonia reserved a table at the Asian restaurant here nearby the Mensa, and I hear that whoever wishes to come along is
absolutely
welcome. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and enjoy the lunch, and thank you again.
Thank you.